Sportsnet 650. Brendan Batchelor in for the rest of the week for Jamie Dodd alongside Canucks insider Thomas Drantz, who also covers the team for The Athletic. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? Interact with the show at 650-650 on the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, and much like this show, when I'm on it, more awesome. Details at DunbarLumber.com. So, Drantzer, we were talking earlier about the Canucks and the moves that they've made. No shade to Jamie Dodd, by the way, when I say that.
Yeah, a little more bit awesome. Of shade. A
little bit, but that's okay. What would life at Sportsnet 650 be without a little bit of shade being thrown around? We were talking earlier about the Canucks, about the moves they've made, about whether they're better or worse, and we both sort of agreed that within a small margin of error, they're about the same with some of the changes that they've made. But the point that I was making was they have the flexibility to make themselves better. And that's sort of where I want to jump off on this next conversation is, what does the rest of the offseason look like for this Vancouver Canucks organization? Because they still have a bit of cap space here. So, you know, the option of a Pugh Suter-esque August signing to bolster some of the areas we talked about, whether it be down the middle or depth on defense, probably being the most pressing of their needs in terms of puck moving ability. So that's something they could do. They could stand pat, not make any more moves throughout the offseason, and then that would give them the opportunity, as Patrick Alvin spoke about earlier this week, to be out of LTIR and to toll cap space early on in the season and allow that way of approaching things to give them more flexibility. Or, as you've alluded to, they could weaponize the room they have. They could, you know, be the beneficiaries of a team that needs to move salary. They could potentially add assets by, you know, dumping ground is probably not the right terminology to use, but they could take on a contract from a team that needs to move one and add an asset or potentially more in order to do that. So when you look at the options, when you look at what the rest of the offseason could look like, when you look at the things that the Canucks could do, what stands out to you as being the best way for the organization to approach it if there is a clear-cut best path, Drantzer?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that they're thinking about it, right, which is in some ways the most important thing, right? More than my recommendation, because...
What to expect.
Yeah, because, my recommendation would be Gustav Lindstrom, Josh Mahura, Tyson Barrie, and, you know, I know people, and Oliver Shillington, right? Like, one of those four
guys.
Go
get one of those guys.
One of those four guys, bring in, a puck mover that your hockey operations group believes, in a pinch, could punch up the puck moving ability of your third pair, right? Ideally, they're a guy who can play left and right. So Shillington and Mahura would both sort of fit that description. Lefty's comfortable on the right side. So that, you know, as you get injuries, as they mount, right, you could have a guy who can complement either Forbert or Desharnais on the third pair. But more importantly, from my perspective, you know, one thing this club didn't do before the playoffs, and it didn't matter since Hronek was able to play through whatever he was dealing with that was preventing him from taking slap shots, and, you know, which he was uncomfortable disclosing to Jeff Patterson. I do think you want to be protective of the environment that this team was able to feast on in those top of the lineup minutes with two puck movers on the ice. Like, I think you want a guy who you can at least see in your mind's eye, maybe slotting with Quinn Hughes and creating that same level of just like withering pressure in the offensive zone with the team, you know, dominating 90 to 240 seconds of the game, often sort of culminating with like a partial change in the opening goal of the contest. So many of Vancouver's biggest moments came off of, you know, those dizzying sequences of control, most of them initiated with Hughes and Hronek on the ice, although not necessarily with both of them still on the ice when the goal was scored. Now, that to me would be like the thing I'd love to see them do. There are options on the open market, but I don't think there's like there might be a puck mover who shakes loose who's better than that.
Yeah.
Over the course of what remains of the season.
Well, and that was going to be my follow-up is the best path signing one of those guys right now so that you have what you're talking about, or is it waiting and lying in the weeds and seeing if later this offseason a team that needs to move some cap space wants to move off a player that fits that bill, or even being willing to wait into the season to operate, you know, outside of LTIR to toll cap space and to allow that to provide the flexibility to add an even better option at the trade deadline or closer to the trade deadline or in the new year, right? Like even Zadorov shook loose in late November, early December. So, you know, I understand, and this comes back to what I was talking about where like the roster as it sits today is not the finished product. It's not necessarily how they're going to start the season. It's almost definitely not how they're going to end the season. Is that need so pressing that they need to address it before October 9th in the home opener? Or is it something where they can be patient, they can wait, and they can maybe capitalize on an even better situation than just using that cap space as straight cap space and signing a free agent?
So this is where I do think the team itself is really working to exercise restraint, right? Because the answer to your question is this team is and should feel comfortable going into game one with just the players who are already in the organization, right? They have to be mindful of their contract slots. They can only add three more contracts, right? You probably want to have at least two open spaces, maybe all three. So, you know, even if you're signing a guy, you might want to send a guy out just to make sure that you have, you know, flexibility during the season to make a two-for-one, to recruit NCAA free agents, to pounce on a guy who gets dropped on waivers that you want, to see a team in the process of making a we're going to have Ryan Reeves on our roster instead of Sam Lafferty type mistake and be able to send a fifth-round pick to that team in exchange for that player services. So, you know, there's so many different limiting factors that the Canucks have to be conscious of and will be. Now, much like me, whenever I fight my urge to jump in during the intro of our program, however, it's not in the nature of Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin, I don't think, to exercise restraint when there are options available to improve their roster. They want to be working to improve their roster. In fact, it's a philosophical thing. They truly believe, this front office group truly believes that their aggression on the open market, on the trade market, their willingness to change things up, their haste in saying, hey, that's not perfect, let's try to do better, is actually a competitive edge for them in team building. And based on what we've seen during their time in Vancouver, who are we to disagree? So I think there's honestly like, I think there's like effort being put in at a front office level to remind each other at the highest levels of Canucks hockey operations, like in those meetings, remind each other that, hey, look, if we're able to enter the season with, you know, and carry 22 men on the roster for most of the year, right, we might be able to open up $3 or $4 million in cap space. We'll need some luck. We'll need extraordinary discipline. We'll have to have 22 guys at practice most days. But there's a path to us carving out like $3 million, $4 million in cap space by the deadline, and still having the ability to, once we've used that space, throw Pullman on LTI and, you know, add 6.5 instead of the 3.5 we could use today. So a bird in the hand today might not necessarily be worth
two in the bush
if we are focused on winning a Stanley Cup, if we are focused to having maximum flexibility at the deadline in a way that this team wasn't able to enjoy this past deadline, where they added Lindholm and then they were kind of stuck and deeply frustrated by their inability to add further.
Yeah, and that's the question for me, is it's those two motivations of wanting to be aggressive and wanting to make your team better now, coupled with understanding that overcommitting to that could cost you the ability to have some of that flexibility at the deadline and really improve your team. That's going to be interesting to see how they sort of weigh and manage the two sides of that.
Well, and so I think what that tells you is you're not necessarily going to view Josh Mahura, you know, as well as he played at times for the Panthers over the last 2 years, including on their run to the Cup final in 2023, didn't get in the lineup this time around, was a perfect fit with Radko Gudas. I wonder why Anaheim hasn't made that call, because it's just like, that's a ready, set third pair. But, you know, rather than add that guy and impinge on your ability, potentially, to toll space all season, shouldn't you wait? Like, what sort of addition jumps over the barrier, right? Like, jumps over the Mendoza line for being too good an opportunity for the Canucks to pass up? And I'd suggest to you, if the club is looking at those puck-moving names that I mentioned and saying, that's not our best use of a contract slot right now, that's not our best use of cap space right now, of what flexibility we have right now, let's see if there's something better that comes along. You know, whether it's in August, whether it's in September, whether it's Thanksgiving weekend, right before 23-man roster deadline, right? Because they've been busy. You know, they traded Dickinson ahead of that deadline. They obviously dealt for Lafferty ahead of that deadline. Like, they've been busy using sort of that wedge or that deadline to their advantage in like both of the previous two seasons. Or whether it's something in season. Like, I do think it's going to have to be something more substantive than third pair puck mover, right? Like, I just think that that's how the team views it. And so this is sort of where you look up and down the roster, and it's like, what could this team need before? And I think long view, not what do they need today? What do they need before they go into the postseason next year? And I'd sort of spotlight two things for you. Although, obviously, the best laid plans can change given, you know, the propensity of a collision sport to produce injuries.
Yeah.
And one, like, would be with a bullet, a number three defenseman, right? I think when you look up and down this Canucks lineup,
preferably a right shot too. If you're really going to nail down exactly what they need.
For sure. No question, preferably a right shot, but I'd say a number three defenseman of any description would kind of, that's going to replace top six forward. A number three defenseman, like a 2-3 guy. Because I think you look at Hughes, no question. He's like 1A, you know, relative to all other defensemen on the planet, much less within the context of a single team. Hronek, he's a 2. You want to say he's a 2-3? Fine, whatever. But
he's a 2 when he plays with Quinn Hughes.
He's definitely a 2 when he plays with Quinn Hughes. Carson Soucy, 4. Tyler Myers, 4-5. Right? And then you get to Vancouver's third pair, and those guys are both, I think, 6-7s. Probably fair to say. That's how they were used on two really good teams last year. They were 6-7s. They weren't necessarily, you know, they were in that sort of like Juulsen-ish mix for those teams. I do think they're good bets to be mainstays in larger roles, but, you know, they're 6-7s for now. So, you know, what you're lacking there is like a clear 3. A clear 3, and I think that's sort of what the team most needs. But I'd add this. You don't necessarily, like, a 3 is hard to get. A credible second pair guy is not easy to get, despite the cost that the Washington Capitals were able to pay to get Jacob Chychrun. You may have to settle, and I don't think it's the worst thing for the Canucks to end up settling for like another 4-5 guy, but ideally one that can like do a little bit more with the puck than the sort of Soucy, Myers, Desharnais, Forbert axis beneath their top pair at the moment. And, you know, so like effectively like a Zadorov replacement, someone who can eat tough minutes and provide some secondary puck moving, but ideally has some size to fit in with, you know, the sort of tactical and stylistic preferences that have driven this team's success. So to me, it's like that would be 1 and 1A, and then the other thing would just be like a right-handed face-off winning centerman. Eventually, you're going to want that in the playoffs. Eventually, the coaching staff is going to want that in the playoffs. So that would be like another thing to add at some point.
If another top six winger shook open so that, you know, you could bump guys like Heinen, who you're maybe going to give a chance in the top six, down the lineup. That's probably fair to say as well. The interesting part of all this for me, though, is when you talk about that Mendoza line, about, you know, how impactful of a player does that have to be for Canucks hockey operations to make a move on that. When when do you think the most likely chance of a player that comes across that Mendoza line that they say, okay, we have to make a move on, is that more likely to happen in season? Or with some of the cap situations that teams have put themselves in with the money committed in free agency, is it possible that that piece shakes loose in the next month and a half,
yeah,
shall we say?
I mean, it's sort of a little bit difficult to handicap because, you know, the not much is up in the air still for the Canucks. I guess Artur Silov's situation would kind of be the one to monitor, to keep an eye on. But, you know, there could be opportunities stemming from the restricted free agents who are unsigned, right? So you could have arbitration cases that teams walk away from. You could have negotiations that go south. That sometimes happens, and a team decides to walk away from a guy. So, you know, we occasionally get those mid or late summer trades. You know, I don't sort of peruse the roles of current unrestricted free agents and see like an analogous target to Pugh Suter. Do you? Like,
No, I don't think that's there. Maybe with the exception of if some of those defensemen that you mentioned that are unsigned go unsigned into August and their number comes down and it becomes more palatable to make that kind of addition. But what I'm referring to more...
Let me amend this. I see a goalie, Kevin Lankinen. I think it's preposterous that guy's unsigned. That guy's really, really good. 29. That would be sort of one guy, but I struggle to imagine the Canucks spending their cap space on a goalie. And I guess the second guy that would jump off the page to me would be Jack Roslovic, who's a player that the Canucks have shown interest in the past, certainly had trade talks with the Columbus Blue Jackets about him when he was back in Columbus. So, but, you know, I don't see like a Pugh Suter type necessarily. Those would kind of be my leading candidates. And some of the other guys are kind of more like, you know, that your Alexander Nylander, Dominic Kubalik, like, you know, maybe it's a 1 year show me.
I was going to say those are guys are
PTO,
you know,
guys, maybe.
Similar like conversations to where Danton Heinen was the last couple of years in terms of.
So there's value to be had from those players.
There could be.
Yeah.
I'm wondering more about like the trade market, like teams that need to move bad contracts, because this is something that you've alluded to, as I mentioned earlier in your reporting with The Athletic, that there could be a scenario where the Canucks could acquire a contract from a team that needs to move off a player for cap reasons while also acquiring a player in that same move that can help them. So one man's trash is another man's treasure. If you know, let's say the Colorado Avalanche have a guy that doesn't fit into their cap situation because of their cap situation, they have to move off that guy. It's a guy that the Canucks could use in one of these spots that we're talking about. You can get that guy and you can acquire an asset or have salary retained or both potentially to make that kind of move. Like, is that the most likely way for the club to be able to take advantage of the situation that they're in prior to the season anyway?
Maybe. I think the most likely one for me would be the post-training camp, preseason, you know, that deadline right around when the club sets their, again,
like the guy that's going to have to go on waivers so teams move him because he doesn't fit into their...
Well, or the guy who isn't going to go on waivers, but he's been beat out by a young guy, and you're like, oh man, this guy, you know, $3.5 million for 2 years for this second pair guy, you know, who's now not a second pair guy for us.
Yeah.
Right? Like that, those sorts of situations where teams sort of almost consider like getting ahead of a potential issue or something that could be a guy who's poised to become inefficient quickly, even if he's not necessarily in terms of how we think about him. Right. So, you know, like the Nashville Predators have a ton of young, interesting defensemen, right? They have some RFA guys that I think could be of interest, like Spencer Stastny, who played really well. They've now brought in a guy like Nick Blankenberg to compete, right? They've got Tanner Molendyke, who had a tough season in the WHL for injury issues, but also wouldn't stun anybody who's watched that kid play if he shows up to training camp and it's like, oh, this guy's just ready. You know? And so, say something like that happens, for Nashville, all of a sudden, do you consider a Dante Fabro deal or a Jeremy Lauzon deal, right? Like, does your thinking about a player like that change? And is that an opportunity that a team like the Canucks could capitalize on? So, you know, for me anyway, I would sort of put it right before the season. If this team goes into the year outside of LTI, I feel like then the balance of sort of incentives flips a bit, and you'll start to toll daily space, and you get really focused on that, and it's pretty difficult to administer. And I think at that point, you sort of get back into making dollar in, dollar out trades, and sort of set your sights on January 15th through the trade deadline as the optimal time to make a move.
Probably, you know, the Four Nations face off. Like, that's the time that they made the Lindholm move, right?
Right, so exactly. Yeah, during the
break. We know Rutherford likes to jump the market.
He likes to go early. So, you know, I think something like that could make sense if they get past sort of the day that you set your roster right after Canadian Thanksgiving. But otherwise, I would look at, you know, like late this offseason, and then that moment right after training camp is sort of being ones where if we were forecasting the probability of the next Canucks shoe to drop, you know, I'd be like, it's going to rain then.
One more question here, unsigned off the Dunbar Lumber text line, 650-650. Would you move Poolman's contract with a pick in order to accrue more space? Wish he could have been shipped to Chicago with Mikheyev. Do you think that's something they'd be willing to explore, or are they done giving up assets to move off contracts like they did in that Mikheyev one? Although, you know, the pain is relatively low in that trade because they're only dropping two rounds and they're doing it, you know, 3 years from now, 4 years from now, whatever it is.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Let me think on it. We'll talk about it with Books on the other side of the break.
Sounds good. On the other side, Jason Bukala of Sportsnet going to join us to talk about Canucks development camp, how they did at the entry draft, their offseason and the moves they've made, and much more. It's all still to come on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650. Brendan Batchelor in for Jamie Dodd for the rest of the week alongside Thomas Drantz. Final segment of the show.
It's going good to have joined. You, buddy.
Thank you. Yeah, this has been fun so far. Emphasis on so far. We'll see how things go. Jason Bukala of Sportsnet going to join us in a couple of moments. Before we get to Jason Drantz, I want to circle back on what we were talking about before the break. A texter writing in asking if the Canucks would consider giving up another asset to move Tucker Poolman's contract in order to give them some more flexibility.
Yeah, my understanding all along, I've been reporting this for a couple months, the club, there's no interest. Like, there's no interest in taking on that money from other teams, right? It's an administrative headache, and there aren't a ton of teams operating in extreme LTI like we've seen. On occasion, the Maple Leafs and the Golden Knights have, like, gotten paid to effectively just administer an LTI contract for another team, but I would be pretty surprised. It doesn't seem like any teams are in that market. Maybe that changes over the balance of the summer, but I'd be surprised. Canucks aren't going to spend the future assets required to sweeten a potential deal of Tucker Poolman's contract. If they're spending assets, like if they're spending futures, if they're spending draft picks, it's going to be to improve this team today.
All right. We're joined now by Jason Bukala of Sportsnet. Jason, thanks for doing this. How are you today?
What's up, fellas? Last Wednesday of the season here. I'm glad to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for...
We're glad to have you, buddy.
Absolutely. Thanks for being on with us.
We made it, Drantz. We made it.
Time to kick up our feet and enjoy a cold one, my friend. What are the summer plans? Are you, now that you're on the panel, big NHL insider, like you gotta, I don't know if you know this, but like I'm pretty sure your contract requires you to send a photo from a Muskoka and or Kawartha lake,
yeah,
you know, this week just to check out for the summer.
Okay, you know me better than that. I'm incognito in the summertime, so and I'm definitely not an insider. I'm too much of an outlier to be an insider. So I beat to my own drum, unfortunately, for some people.
So no time at the cottage this summer, Books?
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, we're going north. Actually, Derek McKenzie and on Lake Wanapete in Sudbury, we're both on the same lake.
Oh,
and,
very cool.
Bruno comes up from Sudbury. I'm a Sudbury native, so us three rockheads from the Rock, Sudbury, we congregate on some islands up north in the summertime sometimes and tie off and have a little lunch and tell lies and complain about everybody, but it's great. No, I'm actually at a charity golf event right now. I'm just at a fundraiser as we speak. I'm just standing talking to you guys, and it's kind of that time of the year too, right, to start to give back a little bit in the community when they ask. So
very, very cool. So look, we haven't had a chance to chat with you since the Canucks selected a variety of players. Didn't have a lot of draft capital, but seemed like they got some value with where they picked, especially with those first three picks. All sort of skilled forwards with maybe some gaps in their athletic profile. What did you think of Vancouver's work overall at the Vegas Sphere?
I thought they did well, to be honest with you, with what they had and where they started. I thought they did well. Like the Fernstrom kid, Melvin Fernstrom, at the World Championships for Team Sweden, he led their team in scoring at the U18s. And I have to be honest with you, I've read a lot about his skating, and I'm not as concerned about the skating. Is it his strong suit? Absolutely not. Does he find a way to play to his identity and get from A to B? He absolutely does. So, there's guys in the league when they get there, you got a guy, Brock Besser. We've talked about this in length the last couple of years. He's not a burner, obviously, but he finds a way to be productive in his role, given what he has to work with. Zach Hyman's the same. Now, I'm not saying Fernstrom's going to be like that, but all I'm saying is that I like the pick. It's definitely worth the risk. And the Romani kid, 58 goals, fellas, in the Ontario Hockey League. That's something to sneeze at. So, yeah, I'm happy. I'm happy with what they got, given where they were at.
And this is also a development camp week coming out of the draft. So a bunch of these guys are here in Vancouver right now. Canucks have opted to go with a more pared down development camp roster, only 24 skaters and 4 goaltenders. What do you think the benefits are to that? And what will the organization be looking to accomplish with their young players this week, bringing them into Vancouver?
Well, first thing is huge benefit to having a smaller group. I firmly believe in that. I've seen both sides of that, where we've brought in, a couple teams, if you will, and then we've pared it back down to a more manageable number, something like what the Canucks have right now. And I like this way better, because you get to spend quality time one-on-one with the prospect, get inside his head a little bit about his strengths and weaknesses, what you're seeing about his game that you like, and what you think that the takeaway is going to be for the winter, or probably the summer. And I really like that. I appreciate that part of it. The Canucks are building a culture. We've talked about this in length, your answer, throughout the course of the season, and this is just part of it, right? So scaling this back and making them all feel like they're part of the growth opportunity that's going on there, I'm all for that. I also don't like when development camps get to the size where you're just a number anyways. If you're an invite after the draft, or if you're a college guy paying your way to get there, everybody wants to feel part of the process, and this is a good way to do that.
Teams always talk about how they don't want to evaluate at development camp. It's more for coaching and working with players. But at the same time, I'm sure there's a little bit of, I don't want to say lying when they say that, but they are still evaluating their players. So what can you gain? What can you learn about your prospects and the guys that you have from a week like this? And what are some of the big takeaways that teams can have from their development camps? Or is it, an error to read too much into what you're going to see 1 week in early July?
Well, delicate, I guess, when you position it that way. But I would say this, Watch, you need to have a takeaway. So if you look at Jonathan Karamäki last year, for example, coming off a season that involved injury, but before that, was up and down at the very best. He needed to come into camp and, kind of kickstart his summer to go to another level. There was a takeaway at the end of the year from player development with all these kids. as their season ended, whether they were at the Worlds or not, it didn't matter. No matter where they ended their season, there was a takeaway from player development at that time. And so player development is curious to see what type of work you put in until now. Like, it might just be diet. You know what? It could have been a fitness thing. It could have been a body fat thing. It could have been, you know, we need to work on loosening up your hips to improve your stride. It could be a variety of things. But when you've got 6-7 weeks in between the last time you played and now development camp, I think there is evaluation that goes into that. And there's some guys at that camp that are genuinely going to be trying to win jobs come the main camp in the fall. So I do evaluate. I have to be honest with you. I don't see why I would ever look at it any other way. Now, you give them an area of opportunity. I call it an area of opportunity. I don't say area of weakness. Here's an area of opportunity to improve on something in the summer. Here's another takeaway for development camp, and you go from there. But the evaluation process to win jobs starts now.
On the reduced size, you know, not the full scrimmage with fans in the building structure to development camp, like, it's not just the Canucks. We're seeing more teams sort of trend in this direction. I noticed the Carolina Hurricanes only had one invite, and I think the player was related to one of their other prospects. So, you know, very much a trend we're seeing across the league. You know, how much of it is about teaching? How much of it is about moving away from the old "we're not evaluating anybody" lie? I'll call it a lie batch, even if you wouldn't. And how much of it's also just to have more contact with those players you might end up recruiting as NCAA or OHL free agents?
Yeah, that one right there that you just hit on is the key. So when you start targeting college players, it's not so much about the volume. It's about targeting the right ones that you believe are going to fit into your system going forward. And the important part of that process is that college player, if you're going to be competing for his services down the road as a free agent when he goes back to school, like if you invite a junior to camp, for example, and he's good enough to sign after this year, they want to feel part of it, right? They want to feel like you guys really value him as a prospect, and this could be a fit. So it's really important. I think that in those circles, when you do invite college kids, yeah, absolutely. That's very important to establish those relationships. Now, the one thing I will say too about college kids is that depending on the timing of a development camp, like Philly doesn't start their development camp till next week, for example. So, you know, you might see some college kids, like the kid in Carolina, whoever that is, might be in Carolina this week. He might be in Philly next week, mm-hmm. trying to make the rounds and establish a relationship that fits best for him.
With, I want to circle back to Vancouver's draft class, because specifically, they drafted two kids in the fourth round and the sixth round. So Romani's one of them, and for some reason, Riley Patterson is the other. I don't know why I was struggling to come up with that name. RPAT and Romani. They're OHL guys. You're an Ontario, a base scout, you know, sort of major name in this business, scouting the OHL. Can you give us sort of an in-depth, qualitative look into what those two young men are bringing into this organization?
Yeah, so Riley Patterson, I just think he's just scraping the surface, to be honest with you. Like, he... you know, if you look at the amount of points that he produced, I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I think he was in around 62 points, if I'm not mistaken. So, you know, and it was his rookie season, 68 regular season games. He played every game. And, you know, he got a taste in the playoffs. So he got some high leverage in there as well. As you know, these guys later on are a little bit of a project or, you know, his feet are what he needs to work on his feet. Like, for me, he needs to work on his feet more than Fernstrom does. So they both do, but one's a little bit ahead of the other in my estimation. So he's got to work on that a little bit in the off season, but listen, he's got drive. He's got puck touch. He's created on a rebuilding Barry team. You know, he's played up in the lineup. He's done very well there. So, you know, it's a maybe. Romani, you can't teach puck touch. So, 58 goals is nothing to sneeze at. I don't care if you're a draft plus one or a draft plus two. I don't care where you are. 58 goals in any league in the world, that's a big deal. And I know he was passed over last year, but I'm not the least bit afraid of that. 111 points. I just looked it up again on my notes. Yeah, 111 points. So for him, again, it's worth the risk, but it's a fast game, guys. And to play to the identity that you need to produce offense the way that they're capable of, their feet are definitely going to have to go to another level. But one thing's to be sure, you don't have to teach him how to score goals and produce offense, and that's good news, because you'd rather have it. You don't want to have it the other way, right? You don't want to have a guy who's a slug in the four hole. I shouldn't say it like that. I didn't mean it like that. I'm sorry. I take that back. You don't want to have a guy who's a checker who can't skate very well. You want to have it in your back pocket that you can move up in the lineup and do some things offensively, and that's what they both bring. So that's positive.
Meanwhile, for the Canucks, a couple days out from July 1st here, what did you make of the business that Patrick Alvin and Jim Rutherford conducted in bringing in Jake DeBrusk, in shoring up some depth players in Kiefer Sherwood and Danton Heinen, and then adding some more big defensemen to keep that identity on the back end in Derek Forbert and Vincent Desharnais?
I like it a lot. I gotta be clear here. So what I like is there's an identity here, right? So the B game for DeBrusk and Heinen, especially when they're not playing or they're not producing offense, there's some speed and there's some spunk there. So they're going to play to the identity that the coach wants them to play, which is a hard team to play against up and down the lineup. And that's a big deal. So I really like that. I like that we have a little bit more pushback on the back end. One's a right shot, which is obviously a bonus. Everybody's jumping over each other to get right shot D, as we know. And listen, Kiefer Sherwood, that's a little bit of a sleeper there, guys. He's got upside offensively. He's going to chip in a little bit of depth offense. And he competes hard, too. Now, there's the guy, by the way, when he played in the Ontario Hockey League in London here, there's a guy whose boots needed to come. His explosiveness, his quickness. So he clearly put in a lot of work. I don't think it was mechanics. I think it was core strength. And he's worked at it, and he's playing much quicker now than he did when he was a junior, which they all do. They become men, I get it. But you got to put the work in. So this is a tidy bit of business. I think that the Canucks on balance did as well as it could have. I don't love the term for DeBrusk. I think 7 years is a really long time, and you're going to look at that down the road. But listen, like, look what happened down the road in Seattle with Stevenson signing for 7 years. It's the same thing. Like, if you want to get a free agent, especially in this free agent class, you're going to have to pay the term, and they're going to age out. Chris Tanev got 6 years.
Yeah, exactly. When it comes to the back end, you talk about having more big physical defensemen. I think if there's one concern around the way that they've built the blue line, it's the lack of puck-moving ability beyond Hughes and Hronek on the top pairing. Is that a real concern for you? Do they need to have more puck movers further down their lineup on the back end?
Ideally, you'd like to have at least three and a half guys that are like that to be comfortable. But there's also, if you swarm enough in your zone, you've got a little chip and chase, then you should be okay. And let's not forget that Hronek and Hughes is playing 28 minutes a night or whatever he's playing. So every other shift, this guy's on the ice. And but beggars can't be choosers at some point. You know, Seelovs came on at the end of the year, so that really shored up the second spot in between the posts, maybe the first one, depending on how healthy everybody stays. And just the cost of doing business. It's hard when you're on a budget, it's hard to find those guys that are premium puck movers, in the two, if you will, in the top four. Maybe come trade deadline, depending on where San Jose's at, you know, you start targeting a guy like a Landon Ferraro down there. Here I am, we're not talking next March, but you understand my thought process there. There might be an asset that you had. And then Ferraro with one more year left after this year, that's the kind of guy you target. But on balance, you got enough to start the year right now, and you should be fine.
Honing in on Jake DeBrusk, Louis' kid. He's been sort of a pretty consistent 25-goal guy in Boston, at least the last 3 years, since he sort of got over like a mid-career blip in sort of the latter stages of the Cassidy era in Boston. With DeBrusk, obviously, if he's able to fit in on power play one for Vancouver, if he's able to find chemistry with either Miller or Pettersson, I mean, there's a pretty straightforward path for him to provide surplus value above a $5.5 million cap hit. But it also sort of requires him to like play or master the bumper where he hasn't typically played on the power play. And I'd add this, we often see players that I really like in Boston, like Connor Clifton last year, go elsewhere. And I'm like, hey, where's the player that I really liked in Boston? What do you see as the upside case here for DeBrusk? What sort of specific notes does he have to hit effectively to sort of have a blow-up case in Vancouver.
I think you bring up something really interesting there about the bumper, and time will tell, right? So the thing with playing the bumper is that there's two types of players in the bumper. Obviously, guys that are give and go from the middle of the ice, or, you know, tip or rebound or extend it, you know, from the middle. But there's also guys in the middle who play the bumper who get in the way to create space for the backdoor slide, or, you know what I mean, like other areas. And so I think he'll figure that out. He's got some bump to him that way. What I like about him, guys, is that he's quick to space, right? So he can extend a play, and there might be one, maybe two checks coming on him where he doesn't necessarily have to be physically hard, but because he's on it, he can chip it down the wall and extend a play. There's going to be pressure on him. Like, anytime you come to a new place, and I know it's not a, you know, it's not $10 million a year, but the expectation here is that, you know, similar to like when Lindholm came in, we need a, you know, if the Canucks are looking at him, they're saying we need a bump in our depth scoring. We were talking about even the playoffs, right? So we need to get, as a group, they're saying we need more offense. We need more strategy. We need our opponent to be more afraid of what we have to offer. So the pressure is definitely going to be on. I think he's got another level to go to. I think that when you, if you think back to the Cassidy years in Boston, he asked for a trade back then. Like it was, he was an unhappy camper in Boston back then. It worked out. But I think he's a 55 to 60 point guy in Vancouver. And I think that's probably what the Canucks are expecting out of him as well.
And it looks like the plan, at least to start, is to pair him with Elias Pettersson. There's sort of been a joke going around in Vancouver, you know, media circles and around the team over the past few days that he might actually be a better fit on the JT Miller line, and a guy that they're bringing in to play with Pettersson may not ultimately fit the best there. But when you look at the kind of player he is and how he might be complemented by either of those two centermen, JT Miller or Elias Pettersson, what do you think of the fit and what do you think of the opportunity for him in one or both of those roles, depending on how things progress throughout the season?
I like the Miller fit better, to be honest. Like right now, as we sit here in July, I like that fit better. I think you got a combination of tenacity and skill. And I think he's going to actually, in a weird kind of way, get the puck more on Miller's line than he will on Pettersson's line. Mm-hmm. But we'll see. My thoughtful answer is that it's going to depend on Pettersson, like what version of Pettersson we're getting in terms of, you know how it went in ebbs and flows this year. I think it's going to depend on what we need to surround him with to prop him up to help him become the best version of himself as well. So out of the gate, if all things go well, personally for me, I like JT Miller and DeBrusk better together. I think that that's a handful for an opponent.
Yeah, DeBrusk feels like he's engineered in a lab to be a souped-up version of like what the Canucks had going with Pugh Suter on that line, or a faster version a faster version of what Tanner Pearson brought to that line during the Bruce There It Is bump. With DeBrusk, in terms of, you know, when I watch him play, there's sort of blips of some infuriating habits, but they've really dissipated. I've noticed them a lot less frequently the last 2 years. But he is sort of a straight line guy, right? Like predictable. And I don't say that, you know, to criticize. Like, I think that's a selling point. But it feels like more of a selling point with Miller than it does with Pettersson, right?
It does. It does to me. And let's not forget, DeBrusk can kill penalties too, guys, right? So, and there's another caveat that I'm going to throw your way, and that is that I think Dakota Joshua's got another level to go.
Mm.
So, you know, you start to kind of balance all this out in your mind. And then, of course, you take into account that they had to grow a culture there last year. Now it's established. So I think DeBrusk, it's a more seamless fit for him. But you're right. He's more of a straight line, straightforward guy. He's never going to be a 75-point guy. If he does, I'll be shocked and I'll be happy about it. But I don't think that's what he is. He's above Suter, which is a great comparable, but he's below Lindholm in his best year too. Although Lindholm can play the middle, I get it. But you understand what I mean? He's a tweener that way. So, he's going to make people around. He's going to compliment people around him consistently, and I think that that's important.
Books, we were having this discussion earlier in the show, just in terms of where are the Canucks better, where are they worse? Sort of, what's your assessment coming out of what's been a busy, you know, 3 week stretch for the club?
Oh, well, better, more depth up front for sure. I guess an argument could be made that they might be they're different on the back end. I don't know that they're worse, though. I don't know that they're worse anywhere. Like, Seelovs took a huge step in playoffs. I don't think they're worse anywhere in my estimation right now. But again, you know, now that the bots brought up the puck moving and, you know, that second unit type of, I'm curious to see what happens with, kind of second unit power play, second unit, two way guy, especially on the road. So I guess I'm looking for one more on the back end. And that kind of feels like what we were talking about for part of the year anyways, you know, before Zadorov came in. So, time will tell. I don't think they're worse though, guys. I think on balance they're different, but up front, I like the depth a little bit better.
That's where we concluded too. We said they effectively maintained, which isn't easy to do when you give Pettersson, Hronek, and Dakota Joshua $10+ million in raises between the three of them.
No, that's not easy to do. And you didn't give up draft capital, and you didn't have any draft capital. You know, there was a lot of moving parts here in this off season. So, I mean, really, I think we'd be throwing rocks at a glass house if we found something to invent to complain about right now. On balance, they're at least as good as they were last year. And I would say they're ahead of the curve just based on what they've done this year.
Well, invent something to complain about. Challenge accepted. Do they have enough puck moving when Hughes and Hronek aren't on the ice?
No, of course not. You know what you just said, right? You just said, do they have enough puck moving when the Norris Trophy winner and his partner, who both logged between them 56 minutes a night or 54 minutes a night, whatever it ends up.
Had career years, both of them.
Yeah, nobody has enough after that. Let's be fair. But, I mean, listen, we'll see where it all plays out and see the competition for jobs, see who's on the wire come training camp, all those types of things, and see where it lands.
That's a good way for us to end the show this year, by the way. Books, thanks so much for everything you brought to Canucks Talk over the course of the season. It was a pleasure having you on weekly. Enjoy your summer, my friend.
Guys, I really enjoyed it. Transfer, thanks a lot. Botch, I'm looking forward to more. And you guys have a fantastic summer. I appreciate your support, and thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Jason. There you go. That's Jason Bukala of Sportsnet joining us here on Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.
Fun doing the show with you, buddy.
Yeah, this was good. Yeah. Let's do it a couple more times.
And when we get to watch a scrimmage tomorrow and then do the show?
Yeah, so we'll have post-game thoughts about the scrimmages. No, no, no.
But we'll talk Canucks.
We will do that because it's Canucks talk.
That's all we do.
There you go. That's it for the show today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brandon Batchelor alongside Thomas
Strantz.
We'll be back tomorrow. Sportsnet 650.